these people know what they're talking about. Listen to them and stop resisting.
If I was to do anything differently, I probably wouldn't be here.
Hello everybody and welcome to A Tale of Three Indies podcast. This podcast is brought to you by three independent bookshops from Ireland. Maynooth Bookshop, that's me, Keane. We've got Antonia from Antonia's Bookshop and we have Don from Woodbine Books in Kilcullen. And the reason I mentioned the three independent bookshops is because it's Independent Bookshop Week running from the 18th to the 25th of June. If you're a regular listener, you probably noticed there was a slight break because I was on my holidays and something happened that was completely unexpected. I read a load of books.
Wow. A bookseller reading books on holidays. That's
yeah, but my reading pace at the moment is kind of a book every 8 days, which proves a problem with this podcast because we record every 7 days. So as you both know, I rarely get to finish the books. Of course, so our listeners will never notice that.
Of course.
What did I read on my holidays?
Yeah. Come on, tell us. Give us the reviews. Yes.
The Alchemist.
What did you think?
It was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, I hated it.
You hated it?
Yeah. I wasn't a big fan either. And it's one of those books that I think everybody says.
The only reason I got it.
Maybe because you're on holidays.
Yeah.
I bought it this time last year in Charlie Byrne's bookshop in Galway. I think I've already said this before. I only allow myself now to buy secondhand books in bookshops because I can kind of justify that to myself.
Okay.
Well, sometimes the odd time I'll buy a new book, but otherwise I'll just get it in and buy it from myself or whatever. But I bought it in Charlie Byrne's bookshop, and I also bought it. The reason I bought it secondhand was because like it sold 60 million copies.
Oh, that could be my copy if you bought it secondhand.
Possibly. So anyway, so you didn't like it. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I think, like Dawn said, you read it on holidays, and I've kind of always felt
I read it
at the wrong time. It's one of those books I want to give it another shot just to see.
And you know how you read book club books in a different way because you know people are going to discuss them, so.
Yeah, and maybe you're very critical. A critical eye.
Ear.
Yeah, with pen and
reading
pencil beside
eye,
you.
I don't know.
Pen and paper.
You were reading in sunshine and relaxed.
That's true.
I assume.
What I liked about it is, and maybe one of you know what this is called because I don't. The chapters were broken down into pieces, so it was like excerpts almost. Do you know? And there's like three dots at the end of each one.
Oh,
what's that called?
Yeah. No idea.
I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. It's like a coda in music or something. But anyway, so. It really got me into the rhythm of reading the book because I could just pick it up, read a little bit, pick it up, read a little bit. You know, when I had the two kids running around and all that, it meant I didn't, and I could set myself, well, I just get to the end of this part and then I can go do that other thing I meant to be doing and whatever. So it just ended up that I rocketed through it. So that was fine. The second book was that I read was The Maid by...
Oh, yeah, I have that here, but I haven't read it yet. What did you think of that? Okay. Keane's making faces, seeing as people
I'm making faces, yeah. I'm making faces that maybe I shouldn't have mentioned it because I don't like to give out about books. And I won't, it's a good story. It's a good read.
Okay.
I think part of it was that I enjoyed The Alchemist so much that when I went into
Yeah, it's always really hard.
And The Alchemist, the other part, as I've said before, it's like 160 pages long. That is the perfect length for a book for me.
That was the best thing about it.
No fluff, thank you very much. Just straight in. So when I was reading The Maid, I was like, this doesn't need to be told. I don't need to hear about this. I don't need to hear about this. Get through this rubbish. Get through it. You know,
where are my three dots?
Yeah, where's my three dots to get me? Give me a break on this. So it was good. I enjoyed it. The Maid. It's our book club book, which I'm meeting my book club tomorrow to discuss it. I think there's going to be lots to discuss because... I mentioned it when we were talking to, maybe that episode hasn't come out yet. I can't remember. When we were talking to Michelle Gallen, we discussed whether neurodiverse characters should be written by non-neurodiverse people. And that was the reason I asked her, was because I had started reading this and the character is neurodiverse and the I think she's meant to be on the autistic spectrum. And the writer... is not. And I had read a review before reading the book that discussed that, and it kind of tainted the book for me.
Yeah, and I think that puts
I don't know if I would have picked up on it.
Yeah, it puts it into your head before you've even read it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then as Dawn
but
said,
it did feel a little bit clunky.
You were reading that book for book club, and I think you do.
Yeah.
Even if you try to just read the book, you don't just read it from what you're feeling about it. You start thinking about the other people in your group and, oh God, she'll hate this part or he'll hate that bit. Or you don't tend to read it just from your own point of view. I think it does affect how you read them.
You're more consciously reading it, I think.
Yeah, I think definitely. So.
I was going to say self-consciously, but it's not self-conscious. But it's just consciously just reading consciously. It. You know, like stuff that you would pass by that you would let wash over you when you're reading it for book club.
Somebody else is going to pick up on it.
Yeah, and you're looking for things to talk about. Yeah. Worst thing that happens in book club, you go in, everybody loves the book, there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, everybody loves it or everybody
meeting over 5 minutes.
There's plenty to talk about this. I enjoyed the book. It was compared to Eleanor Oliphant. Now, again, that whole neurodiverse conversation is not something I would have thought about when reading Eleanor Oliphant. If I go back and read it now, would I feel differently about it? I really enjoyed it at the time.
Yeah.
The Maid was a good book, a good story, could have been 50 to 100 pages shorter, but that's just my taste. And because I just, I won't get too much into it. But anyway, I would actually recommend it to people to read it. And then the last book I read was Corpsing by Sophie White.
Oh. Is it good? I will read it. I just haven't had time.
Right. I go back to when Corpsing came out, there was a rotten review in the Irish Times.
Yeah.
And I read the review and I hadn't read the book, and when I'm reading the review I thought, that is really bloody harsh review.
Yeah. It was a little bit too personal. Yeah.
And I think it was a little bit too personal because of who Sophie White is.
Her persona.
She's a podcaster, she's well known for that sort of stuff. She's heavily involved in some social movements and things like that. And it felt when I read the review that it was a little bit personal. I read the review again after reading the book, and some of the things that the reviewer said I would kind of agree with, but it was still way too harsh. And I really enjoyed the book, so much so I read it in a day. And it is 350 pages, and I read it in a day. Unheard of. Like, so I really, really enjoyed the book. I probably would give it 5 stars.
I read her.
But there was parts that, again, basically one of the things the reviewer said was, she knows her audience, she's written this book for them, or some of the parts of it. And I picked up on that, but that's okay, exactly. So that's what I'm saying.
If you're not writing for your audience, are you not doing it wrong?
Who are you writing for?
So I agreed with those parts of the review, and the review actually, when I read it again, didn't seem as harsh. So maybe, I don't know, it was just where I was in at the time.
Yeah.
But, I really enjoy it. I thought it was really well
written. Yeah, and like you said, to have read it in one day, even on holidays, to read it in one day is...
I read Recipes for a Nervous Breakdown. That was her first one, wasn't it?
That was, yeah. I'd actually go back and read her other stuff.
I really enjoyed it.
And she has fiction then, which is entirely fiction.
Yeah, I've never read the fiction, but I do like her memoir.
These were essays written somewhat, echoes of Fierce Appetites, which we discussed with them, although this came first, so all the way around. Elizabeth Boyle, but it discusses the death of her father, starts into that. It discusses motherhood. I mean, look, it's not a book that I would have picked up at any other time. What happened was I ran out of books on my holidays and my wife had this, and so I read it.
She has good taste.
I actually saw your picture where you were. You say you'd never found a bookshop on holidays, did you?
It was 60 kilometres away. I couldn't justify dragging the kids into a taxi for 60 kilometres to see it.
But booksellers are notorious for finding bookshops on holidays. Not 60 kilometres away.
I just couldn't go 60 kilometres to see it. Yeah. Anyway, before we go on to the interview, I just need to say you should follow, like, and share this podcast wherever you listen to it. We're on Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple podcasts. So follow us, like, and share. Get it out there to your friends if you enjoy it. You can also contact us on atale of3indies@gmail.com. We are at 3indies on Twitter, Facebook /atale of3indies, or atale of3indies on Eventbrite. I basically hogged this whole intro with my holiday.
It's okay. You're still in holiday mode. And just quickly, you did mention at the start about it being Independent Booksellers Week. So just to mention to people about the High Five vouchers as well, that if you drop into your local independent bookshop, they will all be giving away vouchers this week where you can claim back €5 for your next spend, your next visit into your bookshop.
Yes, you can use your book tokens. You get the token from your the voucher from your bookseller. You use that to enter a unique code on the National Book Tokens site, and you get a €5 e-gift card emailed to you the following day.
Exactly.
So that is free money.
And they're
to spend
valid
on books
right up until the end of the year, aren't they? You'll have to. The vouchers are only being given out in the next week or two while stocks last, but the voucher that you'll get is valid till the end of the year, so you have plenty of time to use it again.
Yes. So this week we interviewed a man that doesn't really need any introduction, certainly not for Irish and UK listeners. I'm not sure we have any listeners outside of Ireland and the UK, but Argo
and if we
Hanlon
do, make yourself known to us so we know.
Please.
Yeah, we'd like to know where in the world you are. But
Ardal O'Hanlon is an actor, a comedian, a documentary maker, a filmmaker, a all-round nice guy, as you will hear. And his second book, 24 years later after his first book, Brouhaha, was released at the end of May. And we got the chance to speak to Ardal, and that interview is coming up now.
Ardal, welcome to our podcast and thanks for joining us. Of course,
thank
myself and Tony
me.
Already met you last night at the HarperCollins Big Book 22.
Yeah.
What did you think? What do you think of this whirlwind of they're putting you through?
Well, you know, I'm enjoying it actually. Like, I am a little bit frazzled, I won't lie to you. And you do talk about it quite a lot. And after a while you wonder, like, what am I saying? You know, but I always try and keep it fresh for myself anyway, you know, and try and, you know, find new ways to talk about it. That's one of the challenges. But I've really enjoyed it. Like, I mean, the feedback has been quite positive. So, and you generally end up talking to very nice people, and you're talking about a subject that you're passionate about, books generally, and my book in particular. So, you know, quite happy to do it.
Yeah, it's nice to meet other people in the book selling industry, all the people who work in all the different areas, because you don't, you know, you get emails and that, but you don't actually have, you can't put a face to them. It's nice to actually meet them in person.
That's
it. Yeah,
well,
that was
a
nice
to
event.
Talk about books. Yeah, it was nice.
It was the first time I think they've had it in 2 years, isn't it? Where, you know, a big bunch of writers are together, a lot of writers I'd never met before, and meeting the people who actually go out there and sell the books. So, you know, it was a lovely, lovely gathering, a lovely nexus of people in the trade.
Yeah. And it's easier for us to sell the books when we've met the people. I find anyway that it's, I don't know if it's the personal connection or whatever, but you're more inclined to hand sell a book that's written by somebody that you've met already.
Yes.
Yeah,
I don't know, something about it. Yeah.
So, Dawn, you're
so myself
wishing,
and Antonio will be.
You're wishing a flood of authors through the doors of our bookshops now.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
God. That must be why all those self-published authors come in to see me.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to get you. They must have heard you before. Well, it was nice of you to just keep banging on about the thing I didn't get to go to last night. But
sorry, Keane.
Yeah. That's okay.
You chose God over books.
Well, yeah.
Was
I was selling
Bibles.
No. I was actually selling the revised Jerome biblical commentary, you know, so that was actually what I was selling. But
did you know that, interesting fact time, surely, that the Bible is the most stolen book in the world?
Probably Gideon's Bible or something is the...
It may be that, but even I think even from bookshops, I don't know if you sell Bibles in your bookshops, but... I heard that
well,
the most
Keane definitely
book in the
does.
World. So, and I was often trying to, came across that fact, I often wondered, like, is it really bad people who are stealing them or really good people who are stealing them? It's very difficult to work out.
Yeah. And what do they do with them?
Interesting.
I don't know.
Is there a black market for it? Like,
for Bibles?
I don't know, you see. Or are the thieves that are having, you know, doubts about the way of life?
Yeah. Do they steal it and have a flick through and maybe a conversion?
Yeah. So it's an interesting area.
I have a story somewhat related to that. When I was an altar boy many years ago, the curate that arrived to the parish was telling us that he had come from Mountjoy. That was where he had been straight out of, I was going to say college, but whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Straight out of his training.
Seminary.
That's the one. I should know, I'm here in Maynooth, yeah. of all places. Straight out of that and went to Mountjoy, and he was getting nowhere. And then he decided to get in the Good News Bible and just pass it out and just see, you know, if he just gave them the book, what would happen. And sure enough, things took off and he had loads of people coming looking for the Bibles from him. And he was like, this is incredible. I'm making a difference. I'm out there making a difference. I'm touching these men who haven't, you know, they're finding God because of me. Turned out the Good News Bible, the paper in it, is really good for rolling cigarettes. That was his, that was the demand that he was seeing in these. But anyway, we'll stop talking about the Bible because I think it'll sell itself, no bother.
Yeah, we're not here to sell Bibles. Keane's got that under control.
Yeah. So, hard, like, I it's very hard to pin you down to being one thing. You know, most people we talk to are authors and they might be, you know, a writer of some other sort, a journalist, but like, you know, documentary making, acting, stand-up writing. I mean, I was only watching you last night on the telly on Tomb Raider, your archaeology show. Do you have a favorite? Like, is what, or is it just whatever?
Well, I mean, like, I've always loved the variety, you know, and I've always been quite restless, I would say, by nature. I've always been very curious by nature. You know, I think everything starts with the writing. So whatever it is, like, you know, writing a joke, sitting down, I'm sitting here at the desk that I'm sitting at now. This is what I do every day. I sit down here. Sometimes I'm trying to work on material for my stand-up show. And, you know, in the last year or two, I spent most of my time trying to write this novel. So, you know, the process is actually very similar. I couldn't really pick a favorite medium. But I do, you know, and I know people... I actually know, you know, think people might be quite skeptical about a comedian stroke actor, you know, writing books. But I don't think they should be. Like in America, you know, you think of writers like George Saunders. Like he was an engineer when he wrote those two collections of short stories. I think it was an engineer of some sort. And he wrote during his coffee breaks. And he wrote at night when he went home. I was reading a William Faulkner book there last year, As I Lay Dying. And he was working as a security man in a hut when he wrote that book, you know. So, like, you know, writers, I suppose, come in all shapes and sizes, and some are very dedicated and churn out books every year or two, and you know, some are like me who have other careers, and you know, get around to the writing when they have a good idea and when they have the time to pursue that idea.
I suppose it's the same subject on your debut novel, Talk of the Town. It was published in 1998. But you've gone back to fiction now. Why did you go back to fiction, or why did you decide to go back after such a long break?
Well, I suppose I always wanted to write fiction. I mean, from you know, probably when I was a teenager, a dreamy kind of introverted teenager, I would have written cringy poetry at school. I would have wrote, you know, long kind of tortuous letters to my girlfriend. And I suppose I always thought I was going to be a writer. I thought I was going to go into journalism, actually, to begin with. But I always thought I was going to write. And then I got seduced by stand-up and stuff like that, and then TV, and then one thing leads to another. And eventually I got around to writing that first novel. And it was a great experience. But, you know, it was very tough, as all big projects like that are. And I wanted to follow that up with another novel, but I didn't have a good idea. I stopped and started one. A few years after the first one, after the Talk of the Town. So this would have been around 2000, 2001, 2002. And I had an advance from the publisher at the time, which, you know, is a good thing in some ways, but it's a terrible thing in other ways. It was a terrible thing in my case because I didn't have a good idea. I felt I had to deliver. I spent far too long working on this thing that was slipping out of my grasp. And eventually I had to bin it. And we all decided that it was a load of rubbish. So that was, you know, that was a harsh lesson to learn. So I think that's partly the reason why it took me so long to get back to this medium. You know, the other thing generally is, I think Irish writers, like, you know, like, this is something that we revere in this country, writing. You know, we're all, you know, from a very early age, we're taught to revere the greats, Joyce and Yeats and, you know, in my case, Beckett, particularly Flann O'Brien as well. And you know, all the contemporary Irish writers as well. You think of people like Colm Tobin and Anne Enright and Sally Rooney, and, you know, Irish writers always excel, you know, always have excelled. So, you know, that's a big shadow. And, you know, I don't think, you know, you'd want to be sure of yourself before you set out to write a novel. You know, you'd want to make sure it's the right idea and that you have, you know, you have the time and space to do it justice. So I think for a variety of reasons, you know, I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And also, like, I was very lucky, like, I was very busy with TV dramas and comedies and so on over the years. So I always had a good excuse not to write, but the itch was always there.
Before we do talk more about the new book, we just wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the other things that you've done as well. And you did an episode of Who Do You Think You Are? And recently you've done Ardal O'Hanlon Tomb Raider. Did you just kind of fall into both of those, or how did they come about?
I think I've always had a big interest in history generally, and Irish history in particular. And when I started making documentaries a few years ago, like, I'd made a few. I think Who Do You Think You Are was actually my first. I think it was the first ever one I made. And, you know, I love that whole process. And I love, you know, I love how nimble documentary filmmaking is. You know, you can start talking about it 1 week, and within a month or two, you can be making it. And it takes a week or two to make, and another week or two in the edit, and it's done, and you deliver. Like, so it's a very manageable thing. And particularly, like, during the lockdown there, you know, while TV productions, you know, dramas and so on weren't being made, documentaries were. You could make them. They were considered to be essential work, actually. So yeah, and I'm interested in that in Irish history, not genealogy per se, but, like, you take the Tomb Raider one there, which is very much about Irish identity and where we come from, and who are the Celts and all that kind of thing. Like, that's an area that I'm really interested in. So I've done a few shows like that, like Our Tendency to Use Bad Language. You know, where does that come from? I did one last year called Holy F, *, and that was about, you know, this perception, real or imagined, that we swear an awful lot, and you know, where does that tendency come from? And then I did one a few years ago called Guess Who's Dead, which was about funeral culture in Ireland. So I suppose what I'm interested in is what makes us, particularly to our near neighbours across the water in Great Britain, you know, why did we evolve slightly differently? You know, so you know, sometimes I generate the documentary idea myself, but more often than not, someone comes to me with the idea and then we collaborate on it. So that's sort of how they come about.
And your father is a retired doctor and politician. Did you ever consider following in his footsteps in either of those careers?
Not really. Like, when I was a schoolboy, I was being groomed profession of some sort, but not for politics, because even though I think I'd be a good politician, actually, but I just didn't like party politics. Like, you know, I'd be interested in politics and reading the news and reading the papers and trying to follow, like, what's going on and who's who. But, you know, I was never partisan. Like, I was never a member of a political party. You know, I did as little as possible at election time. You know, I wasn't much help to my father. You know, I always tried to shy away from that side of thing.
Putting up the posters on the ladder up against the lamppost.
That's right. And taking them down even worse again, yeah. And knocking at doors, like, at all hours of the day and night, and people having
standing
their tea and
the
people
church.
Trying to get the kids to bed, standing outside the church. Later in life then, when I became quite well known, my father would try and get me to stand at school gates to try and, you know, speak to the mums who were picking up their kids from school. So it's an awful embarrassing stuff. You know, the last thing you'd wanted to be doing.
You were the eye candy then, were you?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about that. I suppose, like, politicians at election time are desperate people, and they will resort to desperate measures. Anything to get a vote.
There's a lot of work involved in it, isn't there? Like, that you don't see if you just, you know, you see them at election time, you're like, oh, here's that lad again.
Yeah.
But all year round, it seems to be like 24/7.
It is
job.
A huge job. I have respect for politicians. Like, you know...
Yeah,
I know firsthand how hard they work, and how sincere they are. Like, with their, you know, they're not in it for themselves, like most people think. They work incredibly hard. They're very sincere in their convictions. They have this ridiculous can-do mentality, even though they can't do like a fraction of what they want to do or what they promise people they're going to do. They just simply can't, because the system paralyzes them. But And for all those reasons, I kind of shied away from it, you know. And also, I also felt once you start dabbling with the arts, like, and what in, you know, whether it's writing or performing or whatever, you know, I think you do have to maintain some sort of independence, you know, like, so yeah. You can't be aligning yourself to a political party.
Yeah, you know? You don't want to be boxed in as, yeah,
that's right. You have to be able to, you know, comment on everyone equally. And, you know, and what I suppose what I'm more interested in is human behavior generally, you know, and so an ideology to me is poison, wherever it's coming from, the right or the left. It just muddies the waters, like, you know, real life, real people, real testimony, real interaction. That's, you know, what it should be all about.
So when you're doing stand up and, you know, you get that immediate audience reaction, which you definitely don't get when you're writing a book. You're writing for yourself probably first, and then, you know, finally it might get out there to an audience. And so the reaction is, I think you said you wrote this book last year. Like, is that a strange thing, or are you so used to it with TV, or, you know, is it different? Is it very different to get that feedback so long after the fact that you're now talking about it for this past 2 weeks?
Yeah, no, it is. It is really like, and I suppose one of the attractions of stand-up is that, like, it is very immediate. You know, whatever gratification is there, it's instant. And it, you know, with a TV show, you kind of, like, by the time it comes out, normally you've kind of forgotten about it. You know, you've forgotten what it's about even sometimes. But I suppose with the book, it's kind of different. Like, it's because, as you kind of suggest there, like, it's not really like, it's not that you don't care what people think. You do. You care terribly what people think, and you really want people to like it. But you don't write it for anyone other than yourself. You know, you're not writing to order. Like with a TV show, you're just a cog in the machine. You're just following a script. You know, you might have your own ideas, but generally speaking, you're just doing what the director tells you to do. You know, stand over there, look the right direction, you know, and say the lines. So but with the book, it's like, it's so personal, and it's so precious. So, you know, I don't know, like, I wouldn't be one for reading reviews or anything, like, maybe long after the event, like maybe in about 2 years' time, I might have a sneak at the reviews or whatever, see what people were saying. But ultimately, you know, you're doing it because you want to express an idea, you want to express your thoughts, and you want to tell a story. So, like, I don't know. I mean, I suppose the pleasure is in just getting over the line and seeing the book in shops, and you know, that's where you get the sense of accomplishment, really.
Does that give you a thrill still? You know, you've seen your name everywhere. Does it give you a thrill just to see the book in a shop?
Oh, like, unbelievable thrill. Like, I mean, just seeing the cover for the first time, seeing, you know, holding it in your hand for the first time. It's just,
I love the style of the cover.
Yeah. It's lovely. It's really eye-catching.
We talked about that. Like, you know, I was always interested in Russian poster art myself, and that's exactly and so when I was talking to my editor about that, and, you know, I didn't actually meet the designer, but, like, you know, he filtered through my thoughts on it to the designer, and then he sort of had thoughts about, like, Pulp Fiction and Tarantino type movie posters. So it's kind of a mashup of a kind of a pulpy movie poster and a Russian, you know, poster.
It
captures the book well, though, I think.
I think it does. It captures the style of the book. Well, just worrying about reviews, you don't have to worry about this bookseller anyway. I'm not quite finished it, but I'm definitely giving it a thumbs up. I'm really enjoying it so far.
Such a relief.
I know, but it's been, as we said, you've been in a room with this book for so long, and it must feel weird now that all of a sudden you have to do so many interviews, and it's like, oh, finally everybody's talking about it. I've been with it for X amount of time.
On my own.
Yeah.
But it's hard to, like, sometimes it's hard to put it into words then, because, you know, like, the book, like, sort of when you're writing it, it sort of grows and grows and grows, and it starts off as a very simple little idea, little story, and then you start developing the characters, and, you know, then they have a life, and then, you know, you people their life with other characters, and so the book grows and grows and grows, and then, you know, the themes emerge as you're going along, and, you know, like, it's very hard then to just encapsulate all that into a line or two, you know, especially if you're doing a very short interview. It's easier in podcasts, I suppose, you know, where you have that time to talk about it in more detail, but like if you're doing a really quick interview, you know, on the radio, like, and you've got 5 minutes before the news, you know, how do you describe your book? It's really hard. And I'd be really conscious that. Sorry,
I was going to say, well, actually, that was the next thing we were going to ask you, was to try and describe it, because your new novel, Brouhaha, is set in a border town. And you said previously that you got the idea when you read about a real case in the UK. So yeah. Can you tell us a bit about the background of how the novel came to be?
Right. Yeah. Well, I was traveling around the UK, so I would have been doing a stand up tour, and it would have been around 2014, 2015, I think. And when I go to a town in the UK, like to do my show, you'd get there quite early. You go for a walk around the town. You visit the whatever attractions are there. You go and have a nice bowl of soup somewhere, and then you go online and you try and get a few little local references just to crowbar into the show, just because people like that. People like their bellies tickled. And I was reading the local newspapers in this particular town in the West Country in England, and there was a feature-length story in the newspaper about a girl who had disappeared a few years previously. And it was clearly a case that was well-known in the area. And she'd never been found. And, you know, it was clear that everyone knew who did it and nobody spoke out. So, you know, whoever was responsible for it was a very powerful local figure. And there was, you know, the thing that attracted me about the story itself was the details, you know, the misdirection involved and so on. And I thought, oh, that'd be great. That'd be great for a kind of a mystery novel. And I thought it'd be great to transpose that idea to the border region in Ireland, where, you know, a lot of people have gone missing over the last, you know, 30, 40 years and never been found. And, you know, some of those are related to the troubles, kind of a spillover from the troubles and so on. But I just felt like, you know, growing up in the border region, you have this wonderful, wonderful deadpan tone. People are very wary and watchful by nature. There is a culture of silence, you know, whether the threat from the paramilitaries is real or imagined. And I sometimes think it's imagined. Like, I had no direct experience of that growing up. But it was a very common threat. Like, if you stood on the wrong toes, you know, somebody would say, geez, I'll get the IRA after you, you know. And that was like, oh, maybe he will, you know. He probably won't, but yes, cool. So yeah, so there was all that. There was that just backdrop, and you did have that tension, you know, especially around kind of flashpoints like the hunger strikes in I think it was 1981, was it, or but you know, at the very height of the troubles, you know, when there was like some massive outrage or something, you know, it would be tense around there. Like, there would be a real uneasiness. And you know, you dare and speak out about a lot of things. And if someone was selling on Fublocked in a pub, you bought it. It was better just to buy it and not say, no, I'm not buying, you know, I'm not buying that. You know what I mean? So you know, and we thought of that as normal. And, you know, also, like, I was a kind of a, like an old-fashioned kid. I used to read the papers every day from the age of 7 or 8. And I used to watch the nightly news and, you know, very informed by the troubles. The nightly news of the different atrocities across the border, which is only 5 or 10 miles away. And I used to read the court reports in the Northern Standard growing up, at the Dundalk Democrat, and, you know, reading about the gothic levels of violence perpetrated by otherwise very nice, quiet gentlemen. But, you know, at the weekends, they drink too much and start howling at the moon and getting involved in ridiculous levels of violence. And this was nothing to do with the troubles. This was just your normal small town violence. And, you know, this was all normalized. Like, looking back on it now, it was kind of bizarre and surreal. But at the time, you just, you know, it's just normal to live like this. And so I suppose that was sort of, you know, that was always there. It was always something I wanted to write about. I always wanted to, you know, I love the whole small town thing anyway. You know, the pieties and the hypocrisies, like the, you know, the humor to be found in small town life. You know, just the little observations, the little details, the relationships, all of that stuff, you know, I wanted to capture. So I wanted to capture all of that, the dark humor, the deadpan tone, the way with words, small town life generally, and then with a little frisson of the troubles in the background, you know. So that was sort of like the tone I wanted. And I kind of knew that from an early age. And then I had the story, which I kind of imported, you know, of the missing girl. And even though that's not an original idea, and I know people even have a problem with, like, oh, here's another story about a missing girl, but it's what you do with it that counts. Yeah. You know, and
it's it happens in real life, so it's not like it's a cliche. Yeah. For no reason. You know, this, yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah, I just came across the Joseph Conrad thing the other day. Like, you know, the writer's job is to visit the dark side and come back with the news.
So. Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. But you mentioned the whatever you say, say nothing kind of wariness that that people in border towns have or had. Do you think that there's been kind of a collective exhale and that, I suppose, more Northern Ireland than the border towns, there's been a lot of new novels? It's kind of a wave of new novelists who are writing about, you know, based on their experiences growing up in the north, like in the 90s, I suppose, or 80s, 90s. And before, there wasn't really anything. Yeah, Colin Bateman is the only one I can think of.
That's right. That, and that was very comic. Like, that was very obviously kind of comic, even though it was very daring and very funny.
Yeah.
And very dark as well. Yeah, no, I love Colin Bateman's novels. In fact, I was almost in an adaptation of a Colin Bateman novel that the BBC were going to do, but then they didn't do it in the end, which was a shame because it was a nice part. But so stuff like, I haven't read the Michelle Gallen stuff, but I read Milkman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to. I would absolutely love to read it. In fact, I was going to call this book Small Town Big Trouble. This was my original title for the book. but then she came out with that.
We only interviewed her last week. The episode is on it. It's coming soon. But I just, big girl, small town, and I was called a big town, small girl. So maybe you can write that one.
But Milkman was great. I mean, I have to say, and now I had, you know, started my novel like before I read Milkman. But then when I read Milkman, it actually gave me a lot of confidence to carry on writing this book, even though my book is not a political novel, it's not a Troubles novel. But I just love Milkman because it's kind of like, I know she has this reputation as being an outsider, whatever that means. But I thought her novel was really, really brilliant. It was a different, new take on the Troubles. And I suppose one of the things that I took from it was that violence begets violence. So, you know, I think the kind of people who are attracted to violence in pursuit of a political cause, like, they can't just switch that off. You know what I mean? Once I think you go down that road, you're compromised. And, you know, then, you know, you shouldn't be that surprised when, you know, you come across stories of violence against women, for example, and so on, you know. And I think that was really good. And then I start reading this novel just last week, written by a Scottish writer, David Keenan. What's the name of it? It's in my bag here. Sorry. This one, For the Good Times. Have you come across that?
No, getting recommendations.
This is brilliant. This is about an IRA cell who are gone slightly rogue, but it's really funny and really, really dark and really violent. I mean, but it's a great read. I've only read about 40 pages, but it's fantastic so far, I have to say.
That was a good sign when you're enjoying a book 40 pages into it.
Yeah. Now, you know, it didn't influence me because I only start reading it now, but it's the kind of book that if I had read 3 years ago, I mightn't have even written my own novel, you know, but
it's that good. It would have stopped you. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Intimidated me. Oh my God. This is what's involved.
You see, like when I hear you talk about books, you're obviously an avid reader. What else do you like? I try.
Well, I mean, I've been reading the Colin Barrett short stories, Homesickness, which I'm really, really enjoying. And, you know, that's quite interesting as well, because like mine is set in the border region. And, you know, you do have that little element of the, you know, the Troubles. But to be honest with you, reading Colin Barrett, which is all set in the West, in Mayo, it's the same thing. It's small town stuff with the violent undercurrents or the dark kind of surreal stuff that goes on beneath the surface. Kevin Barry's the same. Love Kevin Barry as well. Love McCabe, of course, the godfather of border Gothic. So you get it all over Ireland. Like, it's not exclusive to the border, this kind of stuff. And you know, I'd be very keen to stress that my book, you know, it's the kind of book that I think you wouldn't need to know anything about politics to appreciate it, like, you know, outside Ireland. Like in England, you know, small town England is the same. You know, I travel the length and breadth of the UK at the weekends and sometimes, and you know, you just see it's the same stuff going on, the same howling at the moon by the young people. You know, it's the same, everyone has the same like needs and the same loneliness and the same, you know, yearning for something that they can't put a name on. So it's all there everywhere. Every town has their secrets. I mean, English towns are very, everyone keeps their cards very close to their chests in England. So, you know, it's not just, this is not just about, you know, Ireland. So, you know, you should be able to read it anywhere.
Well, the themes that run through it are very universal, you know. And even I think I read somewhere that it's the location is loosely based on Carmack Cross. I thought it was Moat when I started reading it.
I thought it was Moat because of the wide street.
The wide street.
Obviously, the only wide street they know is Moat.
But I think
everybody will associate with a town they know, you know.
Yeah, it's just, and that's something. That, but that thrills me because, you know, I don't want people to think it's based on my hometown, Carrickmacross, or I'll never be allowed to visit there again. I was talking to someone from Drogheda the other day who said, that's Drogheda. Somebody else told me from Donegal said, oh, no, that's Milford. So, you know, yes, you know, all these towns have an awful lot in common.
Yeah. So it's so universal that, like, you know, that everyone knows everything, but nobody knows anything. Yeah. That kind of thing about...
And everyone knows stuff about people, but you can't ever say it.
Yeah,
and nobody knows that everybody knows it.
Yeah. And there is a big speech at the end, like about secrets and secrets and secrets, and you know, and I suppose in this town, I mean, it's slightly allegorical at times. The book, you know, even though I hope you know it is kind of rooted in a sort of a reality. It's like so this fictional town of Tullyanna, which is a stand-in for all these towns we've mentioned. Like it's sort of paralyzed, like development has stalled, you know, it's sort of like until we find out what happened to this person, how can we ever move forward? You know, so it's about coming to terms with the past before you can move on. So that can apply to politics, but it also just applies generally, like, you know, we can't, you know, like you take the clerical abuse in the Catholic Church or the forced adoptions or any of these things, even though I don't touch on those things in the book. It's the same thing. It's what we're talking about. It's like, until you come to terms with the mistakes of the past, how can you truly ever move forward? You know, you'll always have this mental or moral or some kind of paralysis.
Dark note to finish on, but thanks very much, Arlo. The book is brilliant, and we'll definitely be recommending it to our customers.
Thank you very much.
And
indeed.
And so it's available from. You can drop into any of our shops, but also online at antoniasbookstore.com, manutebookshop.com, and woodbinebooks.ie. Ardal, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure talking
to you. Thanks, Ardal.
Cheers.
Thank you.